Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Student loan debt, crushing debt, has become the new normal. The Student Loan Marketing Association, now known as Sallie Mae, was established by Congress in 1972 and signed into law by President Richard Nixon. The idea was to increase the amount of affordable money to loan students. Two decades later, Congress privatized Sallie Mae, and that changed everything. It's now a $140 billion a year industry in which banks, investors, and the government profit on the backs of more than 40 million Americans who now owe a total of $1.3 trillion. Reveal, a project of the Center for Investigative Journalism and PRX, recently investigated the issue in a collaboration with Consumer Reports. Joining us from the Reveal studios in Emeryville, California, is Reveal senior reporter Lance Williams. Welcome to the show, Lance.
Happy to be here, Ann.
The federal government holds roughly 90% of that $1 trillion, making the Department of Education, in effect, one of the world's largest banks. Who handles those loans for the government? How did it come to this?
Well, we started out creating a student loan program to help students go to college who couldn't otherwise afford it. But a series of changes made by Congress over many decades has created, instead of private student loan industry makes loans, services them, and collects them when they come overdue. And the focus of that industry, of course, is to make money for the shareholders. And the original intent of the program, to help people get an education, that may take a second seat sometimes.
Is that because of privatization?
Well, it's a philosophical question. When Sallie Mae was privatized in the 90s, Republicans, advocates of that, thought that would create efficiencies. You know, there's suspicion that government doesn't run things very well. And yet, certainly, the emphasis of a for-profit corporation, say, on collecting a student debt, is going to be different than if it's a government bureaucracy trying to do it. The intent or thrust is different, and maybe that's the underpinning of the student debt crisis right there.
We're talking about the student loan debt crisis. My guest is Lance Williams. He's a senior reporter for Reveal, a project of the Center for Investigative Journalism and PRX. They've collaborated with Consumer Reports on a new report on this issue. We'll have a link to it on our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, I mean, I remember I took out student loans in the 70s. They were cheap. I spent about 10 years paying them off, but I don't think a monthly payment ever got over about $153. And, of course, if you pay that for 10 years, you remember that kind of a number. What do we know about what typically someone's borrowing these days and how long it's taking to pay it off?
Well, students today are in a different, you know, parameter than you were or I was. There's been a great disinvestment by the states in public higher education, and the economy is kind of sour, and there aren't the kinds of jobs that you could get maybe back in the day to help yourself work your way through school. And so to make up the difference between what you can scrape up yourself and the cost of college, you borrow, and it's pushing $30,000, the student graduating with debt in the United States. That's what they're coming away with. And in terms of how long it takes to pay that off and what the payments are, of course, it completely depends on your job prospects once you're out. But if you have poor job prospects or things don't work out, you can fall into a situation where you're trapped really for decades with payments you really can't handle, payments that dwarf your car payment or even your rent in some cases. And it's a tough situation, and there are 40-plus million Americans who face some aspect of it.
And it's changing how they approach their future.
Absolutely. In our reporting, we met person after person who said, well, you know, I really can't get married because I wouldn't want to bring this debt to the relationship. I can't afford to have kids. I'll never be able to buy a house. It's sobering indeed to listen to somebody who's in their, say, 30s telling you that stuff. These are the people who are supposed to be the full-bore participants in our economy now, and instead they're all balled up with their debt payments.
And that could have a profound effect on our economy in the future.
Well, one would think, and certainly it exacerbates the inequalities in our society. You know, you have a debtor class and you have a debt-free class, and their lives are completely different. Often, of course, people who are loaded up on student debt tend to be people who come from families where nobody had gone to college, members of racial minorities, people with less income. So strivers who don't have any economic advantages, and yet they are the ones falling into the trap. You'd like to help those folks. They might be the future for us if allowed to be.
You highlight the life of the man who is at the helm of Sallie Mae, how he's made millions upon millions of dollars, and that role. He's one of the highest paid executives in Washington. Tell us about him and how he plays a part in this scenario.
Well, you know, in our report, we did profile Mr. Albert Lord, retired, but the man who built Sallie Mae, now a company known as Navient, into the juggernaut of the student debt industry. Mr. Lord was a smart, savvy businessman when his company was privatized, because it originally was a government-affiliated corporation with a board whose members were public officials. After it was privatized, he created a sort of verticalized student debt company. They made loans. They serviced loans for others. They collected debt for the government as well as for themselves. And he was very successful at it and made a ton of money. And that's the story of free enterprise in the United States, mm-hmm. except that the context in this case was making money off young people trying to get educations. And perhaps when we were creating these programs, we might not have done it if we thought the primary focus was going to be on free enterprise and profit as opposed to helping people get ahead.
What part do Wall Street investors play in the student loan industry?
Well, these companies have been, companies involved in the student loan industry have been profitable, and so they've attracted investment capital. You know, it's just the way our world works. But hedge funds and big banks have all gotten in because really there's money to be made. And, you know, the student debtor, unlike, say, the ordinary consumer debtor, is really restricted in terms of getting out from under that debt. You hardly ever can go bankrupt to beat a student loan.
Why is that? Why can't student loans be part of that?
Well, it's a good question. The federal loans originally were could be disposed of via bankruptcy, but Congress wanted to protect the taxpayers who were making these loans. After all, kids weren't getting credit checks or anything. The loans are available to all prospective students. So the federal loans were made immune from bankruptcy discharge. Then Congress came along and made the same provision apply to private loans. And so as a result, if you've borrowed money for college, you're going to pay it back or your credit's going to be wrecked and you're going to carry that that debt with you your entire life. It's a unique problem. You know, bankruptcy is supposed to be for second chances in America, but it doesn't apply, as I say, to your student loan.
New regulations were introduced in 2013 to limit student loan payments based on income. What were those changes, and have they had any effect?
Yeah, the Congress and the Obama administration in recent years have made a series of changes to the program that really makes it better for people who are borrowing money today. Income-based repayment plans, loans have capped in certain cases to 10% of incomes. And those are good things. And the amount of information that a young borrower is required to intake before loading up on loans has been increased. So it's really a better environment for future borrowers. And the reforms that the presidential candidates are talking about, those are positive too. The little of this does much to help the 40-plus million people who are already in debt, that generation and a half of young people who already are in debt. And that's kind of that's going to be the problem that's going to be difficult to solve.
When I was reading the article, Lance Williams, it reminded me a lot of the tenor of articles written when the mortgage meltdown occurred, back in the mid-2000s, around 2006, 2007, 2008. Then there was the big meltdown. But is this the same sort of thing that we're looking at?
I mean, I think there are thematic or atmospheric similarities. The smart guys don't think that the student debt crisis is going to take the economy down, that it's sealed off from that for various reasons. But, certainly the wealth that's being distributed to the bill collectors and the loan servicers and the contrast between them and the people who are just struggling to get by, there's it's a similar feel, certainly, to the mortgage meltdown.
And what about, you mentioned that state funding for public colleges and universities has reduced significantly since the 70s, and it certainly has in Ohio as well. What role do colleges and universities have in helping students fund their educations? Is there any sense of responsibility in all of this?
Well, sure. Of course there is. I mean, state legislatures are in a tough situation. It's absolutely true that the disinvestment in higher ed by the states has been dramatic over the 30-plus years. But state legislatures today are required to pay for other costs required by the federal government that they weren't required to assume in the old days. And so they're in a tough place. You know, you've got to fund the prisons. You got to pay for Medicaid, but you can always jack up the tuition at the state college. That's the way someone described it to us. Still, you know, the cuts are dramatic. $500 billion less put into state universities since 1980, we calculated, and that's just about how much students at state universities borrowed over that time period. So there's a kind of symmetry in the cuts and the increase in borrowing.
We're talking about student loan debt in the United States. About 40 million Americans owe a total of $1.3 trillion right now. My guest is Lance Williams. He's a senior reporter for Reveal. That's a project of the Center for Investigative Journalism and PRX. And the Reveal has collaborated with Consumer Reports on a new report on this issue. We'll have a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment about student loan debt, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A recent Consumer Reports survey of Americans reveals that 45% of those who owe money for college say the debt hasn't been worth it. They are delaying home ownership, children, and marriage because the money they borrowed to get ahead has instead held them back, often tied to menial jobs just to make those payments. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, in his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination, harnessed that frustration of the student debt class, especially among younger voters. This week, he shifted that momentum to Hillary Clinton's campaign when he endorsed her this week.
Hillary Clinton believes that we must substantially lower student debt and that we must make public colleges and universities tuition free for the middle class and working families of this country.
Reveal, a project of the Center for Investigative Journalism and PRX, recently investigated the issue of student loan debt in a collaboration with Consumer Reports. Still with us from the Reveal studios in Emeryville, California, is Reveal senior reporter Lance Williams. Lance, thanks again for joining us.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
Joining us now is Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the Associate Editor of the Journal of Student Financial Aid, Nicholas Hillman. Welcome to the show, Nicholas.
Thanks for the invitation.
Last week, Hillary Clinton announced her plan for college affordability. Nicholas Hillman, what are the big points in that plan?
Well, there are three main sort of buckets of this plan. The two biggest parts of it, the first deals with student loan reform, as you just mentioned, and the second part of it deals with state investment or reinvestment in public higher education. There's a third bucket here on the Pell Grant, which is a federal financial aid program that is targeted for the nation's lowest income students. But together, those three are kind of the pillars: loan reform, state funding reform, and Pell Grant reform.
You know, Lance Williams just made the point that, you know, the states are kind of under the gun. They're getting hit from both sides. They've got prisons. They've got Medicaid payments. They've cut funding to higher ed. Where's the money going to come from? Out of whose hide?
Great question. Well, that's kind of the deal breaker with this particular model. It's based on this sort of shared commitment between the states and the federal government, where states would have to reinvest in public higher education, and they would have to pay for it themselves. I think that there would be probably some matching grants. That's what I imagine this proposal would lead to. Mm-hmm. It's not fleshed out yet, but I'd imagine there'd be some matching grants for states that want to participate in Clinton's plan. They would have to put up a certain amount of money, and then the feds would, through their own tax savings and revenue generation process, they would be able to then match that fund. Not too dissimilar, I think, from Medicare expansion that Wisconsin, for example, opted out of.
Lance Williams, what's your sense in the wake of your report on this issue about a plan to do something as far as better funding, higher funding for public or higher education?
Well, you know, hope springs eternal, but it's difficult to imagine the current, say, Congress or the current state legislatures, many places, taxing people for the public universities. I mean, it's just the current has been running in the opposite direction for so long. I suppose it could it could change again, but that's what it would take, it seems to me. There would have to be a revenue source to pay for this. And yet, did we talk about this? You know, the philosophical underpinnings of our attitude towards higher ed, it's so different now. You know, mm-hmm. A generation ago, there was a belief that educating our young people, getting them to college, was good for everybody. It was good for the society. Now it's more and more regarded as a personal investment choice. You want to go to college? Well, you come up with the money and do it. And it's not really our responsibility as a community. I think as long as we've got that new perspective locked in place, this is going to be hard to do.
Yeah, Nicholas Hillman, you're associate editor of the Journal of Student Financial Aid. There's a journal about this. It's a big deal. It's a whole industry, not only in loaning money to students, but in analyzing the loaning of money to students.
Absolutely. And the journal's been around for 40 years. In fact, it's part of the profession of student financial aid administrators, which is one of the largest professional associations of college personnel in the country. It's quite a significant investment in manpower and expertise and professional practice, this whole industry of administering student financial aid. And it's an extremely complicated aid industry and sort of aid process, because not any single student has the exact same financial circumstances. There's a high degree of personalization that comes with financial aid, but there's also this need for efficiency and simplicity and this sort of balance between how do you make an aid system simple and easy to navigate, yet one that's also responsive to individual people's needs, and it's very complicated.
And that's to the benefit of the industry.
Yes. For the most part, yes. I think that one element to this that I think is important to kind of keep in mind is that, yes, student loans in particular have grown and grown exponentially in the recent years. And there's a lot to be concerned about with the growth of student loan debt, and I'm very concerned about that. Its implications on enrollment decisions, on after college sort of life decisions. But I think the other side of the story is equally important. That a lot of people would not be able to go to college had it not been for a student loan. And there are a lot of people out there who are able to manage their student loan debts quite well. And so, yes, you know, there are struggles and there are problems with the system, but I don't think that that necessarily means that the whole entire system is broken. I think that there's a lot to fix. But, you know, the system does work well for some borrowers.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the student loan culture, the culture of student loan debt in the United States. You just heard from Nicholas Hillman. He is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and associate editor of the Journal of Student Financial Aid. Also with us, Lance Williams, senior reporter for Reveal. That's a project of the Center for Investigative Journalism. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
On the general subject, I want to point out that I'm an employer, and I've had people that have worked for me over the years that arrived with student debt, and some of these people, now this is a few years ago, not decades ago, but they maybe were in arrears on their debt, and eventually I would get an order to garnish their wages to pay off their debt, which I had to do to comply. And in the course of doing that, we tried to help out this particular employee by maybe we would lend him enough to pay off his debt, and then he would owe it to us, not to them. Mm-hmm. But when we tried to do that, it was what he had to pay was the entire debt plus the entire interest that was scheduled. In other words, you couldn't pay it off early and avoid some of the interest. The only thing they would accept would be the sum of all the payments that were due to him over the next 15 years or something like that. So there was no way out of it. He was into a trap where he had to pay interest, and I think this might have been because it had gone into arrears. Hmm. Anyway, it was not a good thing for that guy. There was no way to, you know, borrow other money and get out from under it, because they would allow you to pay it off early, but only if you paid off all future interest. So there was never any incentive to do anything but make the minimum payments, because you were going to pay it all anyway, and no bankruptcy relief, no way out of it. The guy was trapped. Actually, I've experienced that twice. I'm the employer faced with the garnish. Eventually, the guy left here, and his garnish left with him, and he's probably still being garnished. Got to go. Thanks for the program.
Thank you, Steve. A familiar story, Lance Williams?
Yeah. You can't refinance, or you don't have multiple options for refinancing. Consolidation of the loans is limited. They tie you up pretty good once you get into a situation when you've fallen behind in your payments. It's just a cold world when you can't make your student loan payment, and they start coming after you. And I've heard that story a lot.
You know, Nicholas Hillman, why is it that you can't refinance and consolidate? I've done it with my mortgages. Why aren't student loan payments, why are they thought of differently? What's the thought about that?
Well, you can consolidate your loans. There were, you know, not without getting into all the weeds, and you know, that's a different story, I suppose. But there's an old financial aid program, an old student loan program that no longer exists, and that carries a whole lot of the student numbers here. The total volume of debt, outstanding debt, and total number of borrowers are in that old system called the FFELP loans. And if you're in one of those loans, you can consolidate into the direct loan program, which is the new program. And so there is a way to consolidate, and it's actually pretty straightforward if students know how to do it. And that's the problem. There's a big information barrier that the servicers, the companies that are and the banks that are the sort of primary contact for borrowers they need to do a better job of helping students know how to consolidate and how to seek out these alternative repayment plans. But there's a number of possibilities that students can do to change their monthly payments. And I don't think it's a lack of options. I think it's a lack of information on those options. And I'm really worried when we see media reports, kind of like the Reveal report that we were talking about now, if it doesn't discuss these solutions and doesn't offer that full array of the landscape, we actually end up having more confusion in an already very complicated system. And so, you know, even with the Clinton campaign, we hear this rhetoric about the student debt, you know, crushing students and being a student debt crisis. And I think to some extent it's true, but at the same time, we've got to be patient and look at the nuance here, that there are avenues where, you know, people can try to get on track to make their debts more manageable. Doesn't solve it all, but I think it's important that we at least acknowledge that these you know, alternative repayment programs do exist.
What is the incentive for banks to do a better job of informing borrowers?
That's the question. Yeah, that's the question of the day. Okay. For the Department of Education. I mean, this is what they're working on right now, and trying to increase accountability, increase more oversight in what these services are doing and how they can serve students better. I'm not trying to defend that.
No, I know, but I'm trying to figure out what's the disincentive for doing it. I mean, why wouldn't banks be more informative? Lance Williams, did you learn anything in your reporting about that?
You know, I think the level of information available today is much higher than it was, say, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, some of the recent reforms are of great help to people who are going to borrow now. That is of cold comfort to somebody who's 40 years old and got $80,000 in debt and can't get a handle on it. And mm-hmm. relief for that person, and there are like 40 million people with loans. Well, that's harder to come by.
Can I?
Sure.
I think one helpful point is that, you know, this example of $80,000 in debt borrower, mm-hmm. it's impossible to borrow that much money under the federal loan programs that are currently in operation. This would have to be a student who both graduated, went on to graduate school, and maybe even took out private loans. So these are very rare exceptions to the rule of these students who have $80,000 in debt. In fact, the median debt outstanding is $14,000. Mm-hmm. And the students who are struggling the most are the ones who have very small loans, the ones who maybe don't even know they took out a loan in the first place. They're struggling to get by because they don't have a job.
How could someone not know they took out a loan?
1 in 8 borrowers, at least in one particular study, didn't even know they had a loan. So it's like I said earlier, that complicated system where you have not only the financial administrators interacting with students, you've got the federal government, you've got a servicer, you've got you know, students might not be well informed about what exactly is inside their loan package or their financial aid package, and despite efforts to try to, you know, improve that information barrier, we still have a long way to go there.
And here's how it happens. Mm-hmm. Pardon me. You sign up for a trade school or at a for-profit college. You realize that the training is useless, and you quit school after 6 weeks, and you've got a $5,000 loan following you around that you didn't even know you had. Mm-hmm. That's one of the dynamics that you see on the not knowing I had a loan, small loans piling up into big ones. I mentioned a guy with $80,000 in debt. Those guys didn't borrow $80,000. they got in trouble on their loans, and the interest becomes principal, and all of a sudden, a smaller amount of borrowing becomes bigger. That's the experience of some of the people we wrote about.
Annie in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Annie.
Hi. I actually just heard some new information here that there is a limit on how much people can borrow. My question is basically, or just to put this out there, I've seen, just since I went to college in the 90s, the cost of college explode to numbers that, as a parent with a child who's headed in another 5 or 6 years, I mean, I couldn't even fathom these numbers. I was a kid that chose to go to maybe a less prestigious school, but on a huge scholarship versus turning down some offers for Ivy League. But then I went on to marry somebody who did go to a more prestigious school, and we had plenty of student loan debt to pay off. So I've really experienced both sides of it in terms of the payoff. I've wondered, is there any talk that perhaps some of the reasons, and there has been published actual quotes where especially private colleges have raised their tuition just to keep up with their competitors? Because we kind of make a value assessment. Oh, this school is $50,000 a year, so it must be better than the school that's $35,000 a year, and so on.
Well, it's a classic. It's the L'Oreal story. L'Oreal, because I'm worth it.
Because I'm worth it. Mm-hmm. What if we severely limited the amount that any one borrower could take out? Mm-hmm. At that point, it would seem to me that colleges need to fill those seats.
Well,
and there would then be a pressure to lower the cost, because a lot of these colleges have a lot of amenities that we didn't have. You know, 20 years ago.
Right. They're so spoiled nowadays. But you're talking about maybe saying, all right, this is what you can afford. These are the schools you can afford to go to. Nicholas Hillman, what about that idea?
Well, I mean, I get why that would be an interest, you know, on people's radars as a solution to the problem. But I think that it ends up resulting in exactly what we were just talking about with the privatization, sort of individualization of education, where now students are making their educational decisions based on the finances as opposed to based on their academics. And that's not a place where we want to be if we truly want to invest in our future. And so I think that that also leads to, I think, a very slippery slope related to underwriting. And so right now, every student that's enrolled in a college can qualify, if they fill out the forms, to get a student loan. And it is truly an entitlement program, and for good reason, because you want to, you know, not have finance be a barrier to investing in education. And so I think that the more that we go down that angle about underwriting and sort of assessing whether or not a student is borrowing too much and sort of making these judgments without really clear and I think ethically precise parameters to guiding that conversation, we're going to end up with redlining and with a whole lot of other problems that we've seen in other financial industries that we don't want to see in higher education.
Annie, thanks for that question. It's complicated, like so many other things. The conversation will continue into the future. But for now, I have to say thanks to Nicholas Hillman. Appreciate your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Nicholas Hillman, assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and associate editor of the Journal of Student Financial Aid. And also Lance Williams, senior reporter for Reveal. It's a project of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Lance, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to continue the conversation now with an expert in student financing of higher education, somebody who can talk and give advice to people who have questions about what should you do today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the student debt class. 40 million Americans are being crushed by a total of $1.3 trillion of debt these days. Smart planning and saving could affect those numbers going forward. Joining us is education finance and student loan expert John Hupalo. He's co-author of a new book entitled Plan and Finance Your Family's College Dreams. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you. Glad to be with you.
How big of an issue is basic financial education when it comes to a student loan debt? Do parents and students really understand what they're getting into? We just heard from two people who repeatedly said, this is really complicated.
Well, they're right. It is really complicated, and it's different for every family, which adds to the complexity. So I think that the most important factor in understanding education finance is thinking about it holistically based on the family situation. And what we like to tell people is that it's not too early to start thinking about financing college when a student or a baby is still in the cradle. And there's a lot going on at that point in life, but it does provide an opportunity to begin to invest and save, even small amounts, but save something so that when you get to the 12th grade and you're answering those two questions, and every family faces the same two questions. One is, can the student get into the college of their dreams? Will they be admitted? And the second question is, can we afford it? And I thought it was interesting that the prior guest talked about families now placing finances in front of academic or social fit. The way we like to think about it, it's really a combination of both of those. It's important to have an academic and social fit, but it's also important to put students and families in situations where they're not taking on excessive debt to meet those college dreams.
How do you suss it out? I mean, how do you, it seems like a something you're, how do you decide? Who makes that decision?
I think the question about college affordability should start first with the cost of a particular college, and then the family's financial circumstances come into that. And specifically what I mean is how much have they saved, how much is their family income. The family income is very important because that is the driver of needs-based financial aid. So we know there are two types of financial aid that students can receive. One is needs-based, which is income-driven, and the other is merit-based, based on their own particular strengths and what the colleges are looking for. We also know that there's free money available in the form of scholarships and other aid, and then perhaps current income. So when we're thinking about college affordability, thinking about those four or five factors before considering a loan and the amount of a loan and the affordability of a loan is a great place for a family to start.
Abby in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Abby.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a little background information. I'm 27, so I've been out of college for maybe 5 years now. I had a child at 20 years old, so I kind of rushed into making a decision on a career path. I didn't have the luxury of having parents who had planned ahead, and I was pretty much on my own. I got a lot of financial aid and grants and scholarships and things, but I chose nursing, and time was a factor, so I chose a for-profit school that could get me in and out as quick as possible. Now I'm 27, looking at about $70,000 of student loan debt. And hearing about all the reforms and everything is wonderful, but for somebody like me who, you know, at 20 years old was asked to make such a huge decision, you know, what are my options?
John Hupalo?
Yeah, Abby, first of all, you know, congratulations for you to have a course and a career that's really meaningful. I think your situation is one that's all too common. And the question that Ann started with is, you know, how is it that we can better equip people like yourself who want to work hard, who want to get ahead, who want to do the best for their family, but provide information and tools and services so that when you are at that critical juncture in your life, making a decision between going to a for-profit school that may have resulted in this kind of debt load as opposed to another school where perhaps it might have been a lesser debt load, is really a failing of everyone. I think that it's impossible for those who are looking at the circumstances that you face to sometimes step back and say, okay, realistically and unemotionally, what's the right choice?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the issue that you raise in your specific circumstance is not unlike the circumstance that many other families face without those same pressures. I think of it a lot as if we said to an 18-year-old, you know, why don't you walk into a showroom of a car dealer and pick any car you want, and don't worry about paying for it because we'll give you the money. And then they walk out, and 2 years later, they don't have a job, and they don't have the capacity to pay, and now they're in a circumstance that's terrible. So that's, in effect, what we do sometimes with high school and early college students, is asking to make this very significant financial commitment without the information, tools, and resources that they need to understand those decisions and to make a decision that won't put you in a situation where you're now hamstrung for a long number of years to try to work your way out. And frankly, that's why we wrote our book, Plan to Finance Your Family's College Dreams. We say in the book, in plain English, these are the choices that families should make, or understand the choices that families should make, and try not to put yourself in the situation where the debt load becomes unmanageable after school. Some families have grandparents and parents who put themselves on the line for their retirements and after to try to afford these debts. So I think it's a failing of the system. And again, for you personally, it's a great success story that you're able to get yourself into a career that will be meaningful and it'll give you an opportunity to work through those large debts.
John Hoopa and Abby, thanks a lot for the call. I think she brought up another, I'm speculating, but one of the issues a lot of people have, particularly with for traditional colleges and universities, is that they're not geared toward people in the real world. They're geared toward people who have the luxury of living on campus and going to the dorm and joining the glee club kind of a thing. And I'm characterizing it, I know, stereotypically, but she needed to get through college. She had a child to support, and she needed to get through and get that degree. And it seems like private schools really, I don't like to use the word prey on, although that certainly has been used in lots of journalistic reports on them, that they go after that person who needs to get through in a professional way as an adult with other responsibilities.
I think that's exactly right, Anne. It is a systemic problem. There were many schools, and I think the Department of Education and others have cracked down on this problem, and I'm going to say the word cancer of some of the schools that did exactly what you're saying. They preyed on unsuspecting students and then saddled them with debt. Having said that, there are very many good for-profit schools that have very good programs in place with the better intention. And we don't hear about those quite as much as we hear about the other stories. But the reality is there's a mix, and we like to say there's a college, a university, or a trade school for just about everyone. And the first question I think everyone needs to ask is the student properly motivated, and are they finding the type of school in which they can achieve success at an affordable cost? And that's really what we're saying right at the beginning. There are two parts of the equation. Is it affordable? And is it a good academic/social? And I think the point you raise is very important. Is it a meaningful part of where this particular person is in their life cycle? And can they afford it? And is it the right choice?
Rose in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Rose.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm looking for information. I had heard that there is a new federal law that affects how student loans are managed if the loan holder goes through bankruptcy. I thought that in bankruptcy, one could go into forbearance, which the interest accrues, but during that 1 or 2 year time period, you don't have to repay the loan because you're in forbearance due to financial difficulty. But then I heard that the new law passed July 1st of this year that In the case of bankruptcy, then the loan goes into default, and then there are fines and further.
So
I was wondering if you could, so I'm looking for information. Is that true, or did I misunderstand?
Yeah, and there are lots of there's lots of misunderstandings and all kinds of different programs that are available for borrowers who are in distress financially. And one of the programs that you talked about, Rose, was the forbearance or deferment program for hardship. The federal bankruptcy law is very strict with regard to discharging student loans. And I think, as you know, with absent very significant financial hardship, it's difficult to discharge those loans. I'm not aware, I'm not sure that there is a change in the law starting July 1st. I'm not aware if there is, but if that is the case, Anne, we'll get a message back to you so that we can make sure that Rose has the right information.
Okay, Rose, thanks a lot. Alan in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Alan.
Yeah, one of the smartest things I heard, it was on NPR a couple years ago, was that you should not take on more student debt than your first year's annual salary. And I just thought that was all this stuff about student loans and everything like that. It broke it down into basics. And I just wanted to pass it. I forget whether I heard it on your show or the national NPR, but I thought, you know, to me, that was making it simple.
Okay. Does that make sense to you, John Hupalo?
Yes, that is the rule of thumb that many people use. Currently, the data shows that most recent graduates are using something on the order of 14 or 15% of their disposable income to make loan payments. There are all kinds of rules of thumb, but the one that Alan noted is one that we think is a good guide for students who do that. And just to back that up with a number or two, it turns out that the average amount of student loan debt was somewhere around $30,000, and in today's interest rates, that would result in a monthly payment of about $280 per month, which, again, when you have a starting salary on average in the high 30s or low 40s, that becomes a very affordable and economic debt for a student. It's those students who go above that and are borrowing $70,000 or $100,000 for jobs that are paying $40,000 or $50,000 or less is where the trouble lies.
Alan, thanks a lot for that call. You know, filling out those forms for financial aid, the FAFSA forms, it's daunting. And I happen to remember that back in the day, my parents actually got help with it. That's back a million years ago, granted. But and I look back and think they were pretty smart to do that, to get help.
Well,
you know, they sought professional help.
Well, there is help available, and you're right; those are daunting forms. FAFSA is a form the federal government has tried to streamline, and they'll try to make it easier so that we can pull in tax year information. But they're also changing the rules as we go along. And one of the big rule changes your listeners should be aware of is that for the FAFSA form for students who are graduating next May, so the 2017 grads, the colleges are now going to start to accept those FAFSA forms of October 1 of this year, and they're using what's known in the industry as prior year tax returns. So the family's tax return from 2015 be the one that will be used for determining aid in 2017.
Wow. John Hupalo, there's not enough time to get to all of this, but I thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Very good, Ann. Nice to be with you.
John Hupalo is an expert in education finance and co-author of a new book. It's entitled Plan and Finance Your Family's College Dreams. Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, the AllSides interns are Summer Cartwright, Vaughn Hunt, Sydney Schaefer, and John Schlichting, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for all your attention today, and thanks for listening. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.